Hello, everyone, and welcome to No Planet B, a podcast where we're talking about climate change and its effect on Planet A. I'm Wyatt.
And I'm Brianna. This week, super exciting, we got to learn a lot about La Palma y El Tucan, which is a sustainable coffee farm in Colombia that participates in agroforestry, cares about paying their partners a livable wage, and engages in sustainable initiatives.
Yeah, here at No Planet B, we're totally unscripted. Never, not once have we written a script. They're a coffee farmer, producer. They're known for their initiative, their ecological work, and dare I say, general success. These guys are absolute legends, and it was really fun talking to their co-founder, Felipe Sardi, and it was a good follow-up to our last episode about coffee stuff, which I actually got corrected on in a lot of different ways.
Literally,
we released that episode, and full disclosure, I work at a coffee shop, and my manager sends me a text and says, Wyatt, there are 120 species of coffee, not just two. I think there's like 124. Anyway, yeah, so we wanted to do a follow-up, and we contacted Felipe, and he was super happy to accommodate. So yeah, I think that's it, and away we go. What exactly does La Palma EL Tucan do?
Well, first of all, thank you for hosting me, and hello to you, Wyatt and Brannett. La Palma y Tucan is a farm. We're actually coffee growers and processing specialists of coffee in Colombia, South America. And we are located 2 hours away from the capital city, which is Bogota. We work through innovation, implementing fermentation processes for coffee that yield interesting cup profiles, and we work not only with our farm but also with over 100 small-scale farmers around us that are traditional coffee growers in the region, and from whom we buy coffee cherries or the coffee fruit, and yeah, we process the fruit to produce green coffee beans that we then export to coffee roasters around the world.
So that's a very big task, right? Overseeing all of that, and then also overseeing like the people as well as the product, right?
Oh yes, it can actually be quite challenging sometimes, when you're in agriculture and you're depending on the weather and so many variables. It can be quite challenging, as actually has been this year.
Yeah,
the harvest concentrated a lot during the peak of the harvest, so the capacity was outreached very, very soon in the harvest.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we had to improvise. So yes, because when you plan, when you plan a wet mill or basically a processing plant, you usually do it with the peak of the harvest season, right? So you're estimating that maybe a 2% or a 3% of the entire harvest can enter in one single day. But with with recent changes in the weather, we've had days of over 6 to 7%, which means that we've almost doubled the amount of cherries that our capacity could that our plant could hold.
Wow. So what did improvising look like?
So we had to rent some other spaces. Got my little boy here, I'm sorry.
Oh, awesome.
Be careful. Cuidado. He wants some coffee, by the way.
Do you let him drink coffee? How old is he?
He's 3 years old. Now he usually helps me prepare it, but not drink it.
Okay.
I'm gonna have to ask you for a minute while I,
of course,
serve him a little bit of water.
Yeah,
please. Thank you. One second, please.
Are you drinking any coffee, Brianna?
Wyatt, you don't want to know what coffee I'm drinking.
All right. Sorry about that.
No, you're good.
Yeah. So what happens is, the most difficult part about coffee processing is probably the drying phase.
Okay.
Because when you're looking for quality, you really want to dry slow, right? So you never want to exceed 40 degrees Celsius, which means that if you use mechanical dryers, you're going to have either you use mechanical dryers or the sun to dry, you're going to have to go slow. And that means that you're going to have space in order to process a lot of coffee. You know, in fact, coffees can take over 2 to 3 weeks to dry from about 60% to down to 12%. So when you have more cherries than your capacity can hold, that means that you run out of drying space very quickly. So the first thing that we had to do is go rent from our neighboring farms to accommodate all the coffee that was exiting the processing plant and that needed to dry, right? And then, everything that goes in terms of logistics with that process, you have to hire transportation and more people to help you dry the coffee. You got to be very careful with quality control because, you cannot leave that coffee exposed because if it rains, it will get moldy, right?
That's true, yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. So kind of speaking of weather and eventually climate, are you guys preparing for climate change?
Yes, we are. And before I get into that, if I may, I'd like to mention what happened a few years ago in Central America, because maybe people can get a sense of what can go wrong with coffee production if the weather changes drastically, as it actually has been happening for the last years. So between 2012 and 2015, I don't know if you remember that Central America had a really difficult time handling coffee leaf rost, right? Which is a disease. It's actually a fungus that attacks the leaves of the coffee plants, and it can be quite devastating. It was estimated that the whole region lost 18 million bags of coffee between those 3 years. Yeah, only because of the devastating pathogens that attacked the trees during during those changing weather conditions, right? So when you have heavier rains, when you have higher temperatures, that create favorable conditions for pathogens such as the coffee leaf rust or the coffee borer, then you have a problem. And if you don't prepare for that, which in my opinion it's just a matter of time, the whole plantation can be completely devastated. So when we first started noticing that, neighboring farms at low altitudes, so about 1,500 meters, starting having a lot of trouble, as well as the farms in Central America and in other regions in the country, in the world, we decided to study, how we could prepare ourselves better for the climate change effects. And we are betting on biodiversity as a solution, mainly, along with, other practices like organic fertilization and biodynamic, pretty much farming. But out of them all, I would definitely say that the best way to prepare a farm is through conserving and promoting biodiversity. So basically, trying to replicate nature the way that a forest works will help your land, be more resilient, your farm and your plantation be more resilient to climate change. If you think about a forest, you have so many species that are working together, that are protecting each other. Of course, they're also competing for resources, for sunlight, for water, for nutrients. But they also create a more resilient environment in which you barely see soil erosion, for instance, happening. And also, many of the pests and diseases that attacked one plant are also attacked by other macro or microorganisms that inhabit, species that are next to them, Create a more resilient environment through biodiversity. To be a little bit more specific, we try to include at least 24 to 30 species per hectare, different than coffee at the farm. And these include, shade trees and, medium height trees, also shrubs and other low growing species you know, to bringing many other elements to the system that could, you know, act together and protect against climate change, right? So first thing that we're doing is reforestation. That's number one. We try to protect the farm again from leaching of nutrients, from erosion. And when you see the central case, not all farms were affected equally by the heavier rains, the temperature drastic changes, right? So in some of the farms, the biodiversity of the surrounding ecosystems actually played an important role in the plant and the farm resilience, and that was quite encouraging for us to see. So that's one of the ways that we're working at the farm. If you'd like, what I can tell you a little bit more what would happen to, you know, to the coffee plants, to the coffee trees, with that drastic changes in temperature and restrictions of water.
I would love that.
First thing is, you know, the coffee trees, you know, in terms of temperature, the coffee's optimum annual temperature mean is between 18 to 21 degrees Celsius. Even though the plants can withstand temperatures above 30 degrees Celsius, they get so stressed that not only do the yields get affected, but the taste quality also suffers. So the first thing is, you know, when temperatures go up, the plants starts getting very, very stressed and the production yields drop, as well as the amount of sugars that they're able to store, therefore contributing to, you know, lower quality also. So temperature is a big deal. And you know that, you know, the first thing that's going to happen is that temperatures are going to start rising in coffee farms around the world. Then secondly, you got water, right? So the timing and duration of seasonal rain is critical for flowering, because I don't know if you know this, but every flower becomes a seed, or basically a cherry that has two seeds, you know, within the next 8 months. So if you got varying seasons of rain, that means that you have, you know, different flowering periods, which means that you're going to start producing cherries at different times of the year, which means, for example, that you're going to have to start sending more pickers, and farmers are going to start to cherry pick different at different times of the year, pretty much meaning, you know, you'll have costs go up, quality go down, because you don't have an adequate concentration of ripe fruit as you used to. And also, when there's no rain, the opposite would happen. You won't have enough flowers to produce enough cherries to be, you know, sustainable. And that's what's going on. You know, you got some years that you have lots of rain that are triggering flowering in different periods, and then you have some years that you don't have much rain at all. So, you know, the water, the uncertainty is causing lots of problems. And then when you have the years with a lot of water or rainfall, which is what happened, for example, last year, you got a lot of erosion, right? So when you have lots of rainwater, the soil destabilizes, and then you have all the nutrients of the farm leaching away, and then you have to control a different problem. So that's one very important issue with water. And then another very relevant issue with the lack of water is that in the years that you see the rainfall patterns affected by La Niña, right? So when you have a drought seasons, for instance, you have problems with post-harvest processing, as you know. So washed coffee still commands higher prices, right? Mm-hmm. Higher than coffee processed without water. And many farmers are dependent upon water to process coffees that could be sold a little bit better. So that's a very important issue that you can already see, again, in regions like Central America and Africa. So for post-harvesting is going to be affected as well for that. So the predictability of precipitation, right, is one thing that's threatening the availability of water. Where you see a lot of drought, you can see that paired with increasing temperatures, that can devastate a farm, because it reduces the ability of plants to bear fruit and increases the vulnerability of pests and diseases. As I said, we've been seeing that in our region already. And then if you read recent reports, I don't know if you guys have read, there's a recent study of the global impact of climate change on coffee. And it's actually very sad. You know, it predicts that that land actually suitable for coffee will be reduced by 50% from today's levels only in 2050.
Yeah.
So
brutal.
It's brutal, huh?
That always brings up a weird question, because it's gonna be reducing the amount of land that can produce coffee, and a lot of people, when they hear about climate change, sometimes their response is, oh, well, can't they move? Like, can't they go up the mountain a little bit if it's gonna get hotter? Is there any solution that involves that you would see being possible? Any solution that involves people like getting up and moving their farms?
Well, I mean, it is possible, and I've seen it happen. It's actually happening. People are changing land that used to be, put to grow coffee for things like cocoa or other crops, and they are going up the mountain. But that, as you say, that requires deforestation in most of the cases. Yeah. And it may offer a short period, a short-term solution to those farmers, but it will definitely have devastating effects for humanity. And let me talk about that a little bit and the why behind it. So I guess my question would be, it could be possible, but it shouldn't be the solution. We should be looking for other solutions at the farms that are currently growing coffee. Because, you know, emissions that result directly from agricultural production account for about 15% of total greenhouse gas emissions worldwide. Right, and deforestation, only deforestation for agriculture already accounts for about 18%. And in fact, 70 to 90% of all deforestation globally is done exclusively for agriculture. Coffee is still not of those crops, not one of those crops that's causing the most of the deforestation, but it probably will be soon. If we let it happen, and the problem is that when you do that, when you shoot for that strategy, when you go to the forest, cut down the forest, and grow coffee, then you're gonna have what's called a change of land use, and you're gonna expose the soil organic carbon to oxygen, converting it to carbon dioxide. So the first thing that you're gonna have is a vast carbon dioxide emission. Just by doing that, changing land use, and there's going to be lots of soils that are going to be lost from the upper hills down, leached away by erosion and excess water down into the rivers and into the creeks. So you're not only going to get lots of emissions, but you're also going to get unfertile soils that are soon going to be needed to be replaced. So it won't offer a solution, in my opinion, to the coffee producing industry. And it will be a huge problem if we let that happen, Wyatt.
Wow, that's so much to consider. That's so interesting. My goodness.
Sure, just to give you a little bit of a context in terms of the impact that could happen. I'm reading this book. I actually finished it. I recommend that. It's really good. It's the Carbon Farming Solution by Eric Tonsmeyer. And he actually says that since the dawn of agriculture 10,000 years ago, land clearing and degradation have resulted in 320 billion tons of emissions, right? But if you think about it, 155 of those 320 billions have been released between 1850 and 2010. So imagine almost, half of them. And there's still 2.5 trillion tons of carbon that are currently held in the top meter of soils around the world, which means that if we would release that amount of CO2, as well as the additional 560 billion tons of living biomass above ground, we would be talking about six times more the amount of carbon currently held in the atmosphere.
Oh my gosh!
So it becomes really important for the agricultural industry to consider not moving from where they are, if possible, but rather, doing or presenting solutions that can contribute to the bettering of the ecosystems that are already producing food. right?
Yeah,
that's so cool. And one of those, the biggest solution you mentioned earlier would be utilizing biodiversity, right?
Yeah. So it's part of a bigger solution. Definitely, biodiversity is a big part. But then you have also reducing the amount of fertilizers, of chemical fertilizers that you use, and the reason is, I don't know if you've talked about this before in an old Planet B, but nitrous oxide, which is a greenhouse gas that's a result of the volatilization of nitrogen on these chemical fertilizers, is actually 250 times more potent as a greenhouse gas than CO2, right? So lots of farmers around the world are relying on chemical fertilizers like urea, for instance, that volatilizes into nitrous oxide, and it becomes a very potent greenhouse gas. And what we're trying to do is actually to work with the farm's own elements to produce our fertilizers, right? So we're not importing, because you're using lots of energy to bring in nitrogen from the atmosphere into chemical fertilizers and then putting it back into the soil so that it can volatilize into nitrous oxide. So we're actually working with what the farm has to offer. And that's another piece of the puzzle that we're working with, producing fertilizers that are organic and that are coming directly from the farm's resources.
Very cool. And so is that, and maybe this has nothing to do with that, but is this where like biochar would come in?
It does, actually. It does have to do with it a lot. Biochar, yes. Biochar is sort of a charcoal that's produced at temperatures above 700 degrees Celsius. And the nice thing about biochar is that it can be very cheap to produce because you're actually using the farm's own resources. You have branches that fall down. Maybe you have some of the parchment layers that are dried. You can use that for biochar. And so you basically put it in sort of a pyrolysis oven, right, where you create an anaerobic environment, like an oxygen-free environment in the middle. So you sort of petrify the wood or the carbon source into what's called biochar. So biochar is a highly porous material. In fact, its surface area, Wyatt, that one teaspoon of biochar is actually the size of a football field when you put one particle next to each other. It's so porous that it can retain a lot of water. So it's it's a material that's going to retain a lot of water that otherwise would be leaching away. It also gives room for microorganisms to live in, so that provides the room for life at the farm to live in, for different microorganisms to stay inside that the biochar, and those microorganisms contribute to the mineralization of nutrients. So basically, there's a transaction between the roots of the plants and microorganisms in the soil, through which the plants feed microorganisms with liquid carbon, and sugars, and they in turn provide them with nutrients such as phosphorus and potassium and nitrogen. So biochar lets those microorganisms be present near the roots. That's another big benefit about that. So we mix it with our fertilizer, with our organic fertilizer. And it also increases what we call in soils, the cationic exchange capacity. It's basically the capacity to retain anions, which are negatively charged molecules like phosphorus, potassium. These molecules are charged, positively charged, and they are attracted to the negatively charged molecules of biochar, right?
Oh, cool.
It has that, and probably the most interesting benefit of biochar is that it's considered resistant carbon. So when you talk about carbon in the soil, you're probably talking about three types of carbon. You have particulate carbon, which is the carbon material that's going to be degraded into other sorts of carbon. So, for example, when you have a cornfield and you take the corn away and you leave the husks behind, that's particulate carbon that would soon be degraded into some other sort of carbon. But that requires lots of emissions to be part of the process.
Yeah.
And then you have humus, which is a more stable sort of carbon. And lastly, you have resistant carbon, which is a carbon that's tied into aromatic rings that's much, much more difficult for microorganisms to break down and therefore for emissions to be produced. And biochar is a resistant type of carbon. So you're sort of actually sequestering or trapping carbon at your farm while producing and incorporating biochar into your soil.
Wow, that's so cool. So it holds more moisture. It has, you said it was made of anions. So the cations of certain nutrients are like attracted to it more.
Correct. It's negatively charged. So it increases what we call the cationic exchange capacity, or the capacity of the soil particles to attract positive cations like, phosphorus, nitrogen, potassium. And they make these available to the plant. So it makes actually the soil more fertile.
Very cool.
Yeah, it's cheap. You know, you're basically using the farm's own resources to produce it. One of the things that we're teaching our neighboring farms is how to produce and incorporate biochar into their soils.
And what and you may have mentioned this, what exactly do you use for the biochar? Is it a specific like species of tree that you're burning?
So the best woods or the best materials are the more dense materials, like those that you can find, for example, very good materials in the coffee trees. So when coffee growers need to replace or to change the trees, when you cut down coffee trees, those trees, that wood is a perfect material for biochar. So that's the first thing that we encourage when coffee growers need to replace their coffee trees because they want to change the variety, or because, you know, they're already in a stage where they need to replace them. We encourage them to use that wood as part of the biochar process. Also, the materials that are high in lignines, for instance, mm-hmm. For instance, the parchment of the coffee, you know, the seed is covered by a little layer that we call parchment. And that is has a very high carbon content. And that's a great material to be used as biochar.
That's so interesting.
Yeah, so you can use those. You can also use branches from any shade trees that you have at your farm. So again, it becomes even more complementary to the strategy, because if you are growing shade trees as part of your biodiversity campaign, then you have to prune more, right?
Yeah.
And if you have to prune more because, you know, you'd like more sunlight, then you can use more biochar produced by your own trees at your own farm to increase the fertility in your soil. So it becomes a virtuous cycle.
So it's all kind of at like equilibrium a little bit.
Exactly.
That's perfect. Are there varietals right now that are already more resilient to climate change, or are there ones that are being genetically modified?
Yes, there are. Depends on where you look at, but countries like Colombia, I think, have done a great work in working with genetics or through genetics to offer small-scale coffee growers alternatives that are more resilient to climate change, and particularly to pests like coffee leaf rust. So, for example, if you look at Ceni Café, which is like the scientific arm of the Colombia's National Federation of Coffee Growers, mm-hmm. you see that they've developed a variety that maybe you've heard about. It's called Castillo. And Castillo is a hybrid that has a little bit of Robusta in it.
Oh, but cool.
Yeah, but still has, from the Arabica parent, has lots of, quality traits that can offer a great crop profile. So I think that Castillo is probably the best variety out there to show that you can still have great quality producing coffee trees that are resilient to some pests. However, you know, pests get, adapt to change as well, and they will soon
need to be doing
some more research. And in fact, there's an initiative that's conducted by the World Coffee Research. That's called the International Multi-Location Variety Trial, or IMLVT. And it's an initiative that's been undertaken in over 23 countries, mm-hmm. With 35 different varieties. And each country is going to have number of plots dedicated to study the 35 different varieties and the way they behave, you know, with climate change throughout the years. So, you know, the analysis includes like plant vigor and the productivity, whether it's affected by coffee leaf rust in a more severe way or not. And, you know, they will analyze other diseases and pests. And so I think that the World Coffee Research is doing, you know, a great job in that. And they probably will soon release some recommendations for the community. But the fact, again, why it is that, unfortunately, the 25 million small-scale farmers around the world are typically farmers that don't have choices about which coffee varieties are available for them. You know, their choices are often limited by other forces, like they have, you know, low levels of national investment in coffee research. So in regions like Africa, you know, you don't see much going on there. Also, there's a lack of a professional coffee seed sector that's, you know, training them into how to plant these, how to treat these particular genetic material. And, you know, there's also some prohibitions in terms of exporting and importing seeds that don't make it easy for these entities that want to contribute towards research to be able to swap seeds, you know, around the world. So it's, I think it's going to be very challenging that we rely only on the, you know, on the coffee tree as a means of protection. Again, I think that biodiversity and along with more responsible ways of farming are the first thing that we should go for.
Very cool.
Are these small-scale farmers that you guys work with aware of climate change?
In a way, they are, and they are because they've seen the devastation that some of their farms have suffered in the past years. For example, you know, we work with about 120 small-scale farms, about 8 farms during the last drought, which was in 2015, had to exit, you know, coffee production because their farms weren't suitable for coffee farming anymore. So, you know, we do gatherings every year, we do trainings, and we do, you know, conversations between all the farmers, and they've come to realize that for some of them it's no longer feasible to grow coffee. So they are aware of what's happening. They don't necessarily you know, have the scientific research available for them, or they don't really want to touch on that too much. But they want to you know, companies like La Palma El Tucán to offer suggestions or solutions, and so we're trying to do that by opening the doors of our farms to them and doing lectures on how you know, responsible farming and reforestation can help them create more resilient farms. One of the things that we're doing is that for every kilogram of coffee cherries that we buy from them, we give back 1 kilogram of organic fertilizers that we produce at our farm using partly their coffee cherries, right? So we not only give them the fertilizers, the organic fertilizers, but we also give them the training that goes along with using those fertilizers at their farms. And we're trying to have them more aware, for them to become more aware of what's going to happen and how they can sort of establish a strategy for the farms. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely so important, because just being aware of it will make them realize the steps necessary to mitigate it have to be taken, I guess.
it's quite challenging. It's hard to see. And then, Brandon, you see that unfortunately, you know, we're paying them very well. We're actually trying to pay them every time more, but with the low sea market prices. I know that you guys wanted to talk about that too, but I mentioned this because it's quite important to notice that with the low sea market prices, they're also not motivated to make any more changes to their current unprofitable, you know, way of growing coffee, right?
Yeah.
And then if you consider like the new adaptation costs, the fact that, like we were mentioning before, there's going to be erratic rainfall patterns that are going to, you know, trigger uneven flowering. You know, they got to put in more cherry picking cycles. So it increases the number of times that the farmers and pickers have to visit the plantation. And then you have, you know, the use of more pesticides or herbicides, whether there be organic or chemical, they're going to have to apply more herbicides and, you know, pesticides to protect their trees. That increases the costs as well. Mm-hmm. The uncertainty of production. So, you know, there's all these externalities that the world hadn't accounted for, and that are going to become more severe, that are going to become a farther toll for the production cost structure of these producers. I think, you know, we have to be very careful what's going to happen with the motivation and the feasibility of coffee production and growers around the world. I guess that's something that the industry has to realize and work to repair.
Yeah.
So just, yeah, if I may, I want to talk a little bit about my position or our position in terms of carbon credits.
Yeah.
Because many people offer that as a solution. You know, they say, well, you know, you guys are doing, you know, big efforts in reforestation. Why don't you sort of, you know, issue carbon credits and then sell them to the world?
Now, could you explain a little bit what a carbon credit is?
Sure. Yeah, right. Basically, it's a title, right? It's a you know, a piece of paper or a commitment that can be transacted, that can be sold in the market, that pretty much has a value that relates to a CO2 emission that was avoided. So, cool. In other words, if I'm not emitting a certain amount of greenhouse gases, you know, I can be given a certain number of carbon credits, and then I can sell to somebody who needs to offset a particular emission requirement, either by the institution, by the governments, or by their board, or, you know, something has been requested by their consumers. That it's measured in metric tons of CO2. But my problem with those, as I was saying, what is that? It's the offset word in the equation, right? Because what you're doing is, I mean, you're pretty much offsetting the other side. So to me, the carbon credits present sort of an unbalanced equation in which not everybody is working the same way.
Okay.
I guess, of course, you know, when you look at the short term, it can be convincing that, you know, one side is working to offset the other side. But I think at this point where we are now today, everybody should be working towards the same goal. I mean, everybody should be working about in cutting down emissions rather than offsetting one's emissions with somebody around the world. Especially when you see the emissions per capita in different countries. Like, I had the opportunity to study at Melbourne University not long ago. I took a postgraduate degree.
Awesome. Congratulations on that, by the way.
Yes, thank you. In agricultural sciences. And we had a really cool class where we saw, you know, carbon credits and how they worked. And pretty much they told us, look, countries like Australia, the U.S. have, you know, very high emissions, and some countries in Europe per capita, even above 10 metric tons per capita per year. Whereas, you know, producing, or what they call now the global south countries of the world, have maybe two or three, in the case of Central America and South America, two or three metric tons of greenhouse gas emissions per capita per year.
I see. So it's a little bit of balance. It's a little bit of us on this side cutting down isn't going to help people who are a little bit on the heavier side of the scale, because they're not cutting down at all. It almost doesn't really balance out in a helpful way.
And then you still have to listen to some of the arguments of developing countries like India, for instance. They're saying, well, you know, we need to develop you know, until the world presents us with different technologies that are not as, you know, that are not big contributors to the emissions as they are today, we still need to develop. We need to take our people out of poverty. How are we supposed to develop as a country or as a region if we're not able to sort of use the industrial technology that's available today? So they still need a leeway, right? I'm not saying that they should be responsible, but I think the world has to be committed to, you know, to both sides, right? First, you gotta cut down, and then you can offer the other side a little bit of leeway to develop as well. So you know, most of the biodiversity and most of the of the land that hasn't been cleared is in countries that are in the global south of the world that need to develop. And it's better for us to help them develop in a responsible way than to ask them not to develop at all. I think that the carbon credit market sort of assumes that, you know, pretty much these projects need to sequester carbon and sort of offset other industries that can continue with the heavy emissions that they've been using for decades. And I guess, yeah, my point is that we should all be working towards the same goal, towards the same side.
Yeah.
And not offsetting each other.
Yeah. Now, so earlier you mentioned how, when you're talking about deforestation, how there's a lot of carbon stored in soil. Is carbon sequestering, can that be related to like how much soil can hold carbon? That might be kind of a buck wild question, but like, would those ideas be related at all?
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. In fact, I mean, you do carbon sequestration, you know, through a buildup of organic matter, right? So, you know, when you sort of create soil, or you know, soil needs millions of years to be created as when you define soil in a scientific way. But then, if you build up organic matter with responsible farming, so no tilling, for instance, all the carbon that becomes resistant carbon will be stored for millions of years in your soil, as long as you don't expose it to sunlight and to rain and to oxygen, as you would in deforestation. So yes, farming, actually agroforestry and responsible farming, can offer a solution to sequester carbon in a very relevant way. I'm not saying that's the only way that we should be, you know, looking at, but it is definitely a big part of the equation, or a big part of the solution, when you put the numbers together. You know, there's a lot of carbon to be kept in our soils, and a lot of carbon that can be stored with the help of nature, with the help of trees, if we planted them and if we use them as part of our ecosystems, you know, in a way that's feasible for them. Because if you have a monoculture somewhere in Iowa or in Colombia, then you really don't need any trees. You really don't need, you know, to be honest, much organic matter, because you're putting in so many external inputs that pretty much they're running on everything external. But if you, rather than having a monoculture, you know, you'd have a polyculture, right? So a mixture of many different species. And one of them was corn, if you were interested in doing corn, then you'd be really contributing towards a solution whilst you're producing, you know, what you want to produce as a farmer.
Yeah.
So there's this new project that we've launched. And if you're interested, it's the website is called www.biodiversal.com. So it's sort of a biodiversity for everybody. And we're going to be beginning with small scale farmers. And what we're doing is, we're offering sort of a technology package, or, you know, information and help to small-scale coffee farmers in Colombia and hopefully in the rest of the world later on.
Wow.
It's biodiversal.com.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And the idea is that biodiversity really becomes, you know, profitable, right? So not only are they becoming more resilient, their farms, but also they are becoming more productive, They're diversifying their risks by having different incomes derived from different products, as well as in different time cycles. Because with monocultures, like most of the coffee planted in the world, you got just one crop.
Yeah.
And that single crop produces maybe once or at the most twice a year. Then you got the cash flow cycle is awful, right? Because you only have one or two big payments. And and that's something that doesn't go really well with people that are not very highly educated or do not have the means to save. So biodiversity not only offers more resilience to the farms, the ecosystems, but also another solution for income diversification, as well as risk diversification. And we're betting on that. And what we're trying to do with this program is to educate small scale farmers and work together with them and biodiversity to produce more value added products other than coffee in coffee farms, right? So think about spices, for instance, turmeric, cardamom, pepper, right? These are all value added products that can be produced in coffee plantations. Think about wood trees,
okay,
like timber as their savings account, right? I mean, for 10 years, if you nurture and you maintain, oaks and eucalyptus or different guayaca and different wood trees, timber, then that would become not only essential for the ecosystem, but also it could be then replaced by other new trees when you take it down and cash in that sort of a savings account. Then you can also have livestock. At the farm, we're at the moment we're experimenting with sheep. The sheep, they're eating the weeds of coffee fields without harming the trees. They're not compacting the soil. They're fertilizing as they walk, and they are gaining weight. So it becomes essential for food security for the families, as well as a good fertilization tool. That's part of the ecosystem. And dogs are also a good example of that, as well as chicken. And there's so many great examples about how biodiversity can contribute not only to a better, ecosystem, but also to a more diversified farm.
Wow. So I'm looking at the website right now. This is really cool. these are products that are being grown on coffee farms, and by growing them on coffee farms, you're increasing the biodiversity of these farms?
That is correct. Honey, for instance, I mean, while I think about it for a minute, honeybees are under threat.
Yeah.
And in a coffee farm, there's research, there's scientific research showing that pollinization of honeybees can actually increase up to 18% the yield in a coffee farm alone.
Really?
And then if you have more flowers of different species to offer the bees, then you'll have honey, right, as a byproduct. And honey is great for income diversification and production also. So, I mean, with diversification of the species at the farm, you can also bring more bees, which gives a better yields on the coffee and on the other species that you are cultivating. So that's our bet, biodiversity.
Do we want to dive into listener questions?
Yeah, I'm down. These are straight from our listeners, so you can't you legally can't blame us for these.
No worries. I respect every question. Please.
Cool.
So someone wanted you to kind of explain fair trade, rainforest friendly, and pollinator or bird friendly coffee labels.
Sure. So these are all what they called in the industry certified coffees or certifications for a particular attribute. So for instance, bird friendly is, I believe, the Smithsonian Institute that certifies a certain coffee plantation as bird friendly. But that basically means that it has to have a certain amount of species, with a certain height in terms of trees at a certain distance or density, so that it could guarantee that the ecosystem is holding you know, a number of bird species that inhabit amongst coffee trees. And I think that's a really cool, you know, way of promoting the coffee plantations that are responsible with bird species and, of course, with biodiversity. Then you have a Rainforest Alliance that pretty much works the same, except that rainforest goes beyond the bird, you know, friendly certification in the sense that it also looks at, you know, so responsibility between, you know, the farmer and the labor that he or she employs at the farm, the way that everything is marked and organized at the farm, you know, the delimitations between chemical, pesticides, herbicides, and the process. So it goes a little bit beyond the diversity and the protection of nature, and gets a little bit into the farm's practices. So that's sort of a rainforest, and then there's fair trade. I'm going to leave fair trade for the end. I think rainforest and bird friendly are very good initiatives. Unfortunately, my my concern with those certifications is that people are sort of commoditizing those certifications. So they've already labeled them into, you know, like a price range, right? So they've given them a certain price. So X number of cents per pound if you're a rainforest certified, and X number of cents per pound if you're bird friendly, and it's already become a commodity. That's not enough for farmers who are, you know, doing such big efforts to attain those certifications. And that's unfortunate, because I really think that those are very good initiatives that should be worth more for the public, right? Mm-hmm. Let's talk about fair trade. And this may be a little bit, different from what people think, but I really believe
that... Are you about to get into controversy?
Yeah, a little bit controversial, right? I really believe that fair trade is not effective as a certification, and I say that because if you look at the fair trade structure, in my opinion, right, it doesn't account for volatilities in currencies, right, in other currencies that are not dollar or U.S. dollars. So it doesn't account for devaluation of those currencies. It doesn't account for inflation in those countries. Mm. And it doesn't even cover 30% of what the coffee producers who are certified can offer. So it doesn't really, in my opinion, change much and guarantee a minimum price. So the fact that it guarantees a minimum price in US dollars per pound doesn't mean that it guarantees food security or food sovereignty for a family, because it does not guarantee a minimum income as a whole for the farm. So when it goes up, the peso and the dollar remains low, it doesn't account for those changes in volatility. It also doesn't account for changes in inflation in terms of local currency. So I think the fair trade system needs to be thought of as something that's not done what it's supposed to do, because it's also becoming a very expensive certification. Remember that you have to pay a certain amount of money every number of years as a cooperative or as a coffee growing community for that to happen, right?
Now this one says, will coffee farmers be having less kids? I guess justification being less mouths to feed equals less demand for food.
I have no idea.
Okay,
but my very guess fair. would be that if you see the coffee growing population in Colombia, for example, it's already above 60 years old.
I see.
So I think the problem is that there's not going to be young coffee growers to have kids anymore. Their sons and grandsons are actually fleeing, are leaving to the big cities. So I don't see coffee growers having kids, because I don't see young coffee growers often.
Do you know what crops or foods will disappear first with climate change?
There's a very very interesting section in this book that I mentioned, Brenna. It's called The Carbon Farming Solution. It's right, and definitely he mentions many of the first, you know, hard impacts that are going to be suffering as as we get to 1 degree or 2 degrees or even 4 degrees above, you know, averages in terms of temperature and the types of crops that are going to appear first. But ironically, for example, something that I studied at the University of Melbourne that caught my attention is that in the, you know, short term, sort of speak, many crops are going to be benefited as a result of the extra carbon dioxide that's going to be in the atmosphere. As you know, plants use carbon dioxide to build their structures, right? So ironically, you know, like for instance, cornfields have been studied recently to react positively to the amount of extra carbon dioxide that's going to be emitted, you know, in the next few decades. And I, it's ironic, but it's just part of a big change that will have very devastating consequences later on.
Here's a listener question. As the dolphins, so this one's this one's kind of talking about a little bit of sea level rise in here too. As the dolphins' domain increases and humanity's lands disappear, what tactics will we have to resort to in our fight for available farmlands?
I really think the way that the question is structured is quite funny, but it's a really good question. Definitely, again, I would bet for reforestation. I would bet for more sustainable practices in terms of farming. So, you know, no tilling, no usage of chemical fertilizers, pesticides, and herbicides. More shade, more trees, more species to create a more resilient farm. Because, again, you could always go for the mountain. You could always go for the forest. But that's only going to last us for so long, right?
Yeah.
So the best strategy would be to, you know, to save what we have, and to work with what we have in a more responsible way. So yeah, and unfortunately, there's many, you know, many farmers that are not going to have that option anymore. In fact, you know, we're seeing in the coffee industry, as I said, that many farms have switched to other crops like cocoa, and you know, there's no way back, at least not that we know of. You see the permafrost is melting, glaciers are shrinking, there is less fresh water available, you know, the water that's available is declining in quality. You see you know, the coral reefs and Arctic ecosystems declining rapidly. I mean, you've guys seen it in Florida, the number of category 4 and 5 hurricanes has almost doubled. Only between 1970 and today, right? And farmers around the world are reporting that the rains are coming at different times, throwing off farming season. You know, so we're seeing lower crop yields everywhere. So some of the land, some of the farmland will not be able, or I think we're not going to be able to save it. But the one that still has a possibility should be thinking about biodiversity, in my opinion, and reforestation and sustainable farming practices as a solution.
Are there certain countries that are going to be affected, like, sooner than others by climate change?
Yes, definitely. The ones that, I think the whole world is going to be affected in one way or the other soon. But the ones that the case studies that I reviewed at Melbourne Uni, you know, were of course in Australia. The Mali region, for instance, which is one of the most arid regions in the world, and definitely one of the most in Australia, was experiencing even more intense droughts, right, than it used to. So those regions that are very hot are going to start experiencing shortages of available water. And also, I remember studying about the tropics, right? So, for instance, you know, near the equator, where we are, we have some rain patterns, as I was mentioning, that used to be sort of predictable. So, you know, one of the first things that in the tropics you're going to experiment is that the unpredictability of those rain patterns, and also the amount of water that's going to be coming down when it's rainy season. So the tropics are very fragile. Remember that the tropics are very important for humanity, not only because that's where you find most of the biodiversity and the forests and trees that produce the oxygen that we breathe, but also because most of the water that's produced in the planet planet Earth comes from places like Colombia, right? We are the second most biodiverse country in the world. I think we have a huge amount of the water reserves, fresh reserves, and we're seeing a huge devastation on these very fragile places because of the changes in weather patterns. So the tropics definitely are going to be hit very hard. And then the coastline. I think you guys had a podcast about the shoreline and Miami, flood that's going on in places, in cities like Miami. Definitely, the coastline around the world is going to be affected very soon. But yeah, the climate change paired with very low prices is a formula that's a disaster, in my opinion, for the future.
Awesome. I think that's all the questions we have. Is there anything you want to promote here at the end?
Thank you for the opportunity. Thank you very much for this initiative. I think that the world needs to listen to everybody, not only in the consuming countries but also in the producing countries, as you are. You're inviting people from different parts of the world and different trajectories. So thank you for that. Thank you for that opportunity. And again, please welcome to La Palma del Tucán whenever you want. Just let me know. I'll be there to show you around and, with full traceability, what we do, what we still don't do, what we want to do in the next few years, and what works and what doesn't, right? Because one thing that we're going to be very clear about is that we're going to publish everything that we do in the most professional way so that other farmers around the world can use our data to change, hopefully to adapt. And also, we'd love to hear from other farmers, around the world, what they're doing, try to implement some of their strategies.
Yeah.
So thank you very much for these spaces that are necessary for everybody to be more aware of what's going on and hopefully to act fast.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for being here. It means so very much.
Oh, Wyatt, my pleasure. Perfect. Thanks for this beautiful, beautiful initiative, guys.
Of course, yeah. This was lovely.
Thank you.
Gracias.
Thank
Gracias.
You. Yeah, ciao. Travel safe. Take care of the kid.
Yeah, well, thank you. I'll try my best.
Oh, you're still listening? Hello. Thanks for listening.
And thanks, Felipe.
I hope this was as fun of an interview to listen to as it was for us to do.
If you're not already, follow us on No Planet B Cast on both Instagram and Twitter.
Maybe soon we'll be on Bumble?
Perhaps. I was thinking Hinge.
Yeah, Hinge is probably the most tasteful one right now.
What about eHarmony?
I really like the idea. eHarmony is dead. Don't ever talk about big eHarmony ever again.
Low-key, though,
Bumble BFF is where you'll find No Planet B next. No, good for them. I'm glad. Follow us on Instagram and Twitter. We'll be uploading our reference documents. And if you like the episode, if you like any of these episodes, give us a 5-star. It would mean so much. And maybe share an episode with a friend who enjoys climate change.
Or who doesn't.
or who likes coffee. Or who doesn't, and that's it. We'll see you on the internet.
Adios.
Gone. Oh, I have to pee so bad, dude.